Good morning, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of the Science for the Equestrian Soul podcast with me, Selina Skogan. Today, I have my friend and colleague, Ilvi Frost, on the podcast. And as we have both been going down this journey about equestrian pain or equine pain, better, equestrian pain is also a thing, but equine pain, this is what we are talking about today and are sharing some insights that we got on our journey and giving you a few tips how to deal with cases of insecurity and how to deal with a rehabilitation process. I hope you enjoy listening the episode as much as I enjoyed making it. So have a lot of fun. Good morning. Today we are having my dear friend Ilvi Voss on the podcast. So I'm saying hello to the Netherlands. Good morning, Ilvi.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. We are busy recording podcasts right now because we are actually having a Christmas special for our listeners where we are having an episode each week. In my normal life, I don't manage to have an episode each week. That's more like each month. But, but that gives us a possibility to finally also record our podcast that we have in the pipeline since half a year.
Yeah, we've been talking about it a very long time.
Very long. Exactly. So now we are doing it. And you are just coming back from vacation. You have been traveling a little bit. And I'm grateful that you take the time for us here anyway this morning, back in the Netherlands.
My voice sounds a little bit funny. I went from palm trees at the Mediterranean to Switzerland, 40 centimeters of snow within one day.
Wow.
And I did catch a little bit of a cold, so hence the scarf and the hot drink and the funny voice.
So then you need to get cozy now. And we are talking for a good hour here, or as long as your voice is doing it. Let's say it like this. So we met at the trainer group, or we met even before the trainer group at Bernd Branderup's place. I remember some nice and cozy evenings at the intern's house before you were even writing your square test. Yeah,
that was 2008. It was my first time that I came to Denmark as a week student. It was my very first time arriving at Ben's place, and you were a practicant there.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Wow, we are growing old.
Yes.
Okay. But even though we met there, you did not start your writing career with academic art of writing. Let's talk a little bit about your background.
Yes. How far back shall I go? Because we are getting old. So there is a long history to talk about.
Okay, we don't start with the Children's Writing Pony Club, but we do start with where things are getting a bit more serious, and which is basically still influencing you in your career today.
Well, actually, then we do have to go back to my children writing club, because I've been very serious from a very young age, because I was not even a teenager yet, who was always in the stable with the horses that nobody liked. So the one who would kick out people out of the box, the one that would be bolting during the riding lesson, those were the horses that I was always kind of attracted to. And my first pony was like that. She had a very terrible abuse background. And it took me 4 years before I was not being kicked out of the box anymore of my own pony.
Oh, my.
So my parents were like ready to sell that pony or send it back to the previous owners, I think like 20 times already in the first 6 months. And I was the one who was like, you know, I was 10 or 11, who was like, no, and I'm going to become friends with this pony because it's really sad and nobody understands her. So I'm going to fix this. And it took me a while, and I got a few bruises and bumps and trips to the hospital, but we did kind of find a way. And I think I was always the one that, you know, if the mainstream was doing competitions, I was the one riding bareback and without the saddle. And if the mainstream was saying your pony is being naughty, you just have to kick it harder, I was the one who would park my pony in the middle and ask the teacher, what does beating my pony bring me in terms of a relationship? Now, I was 14 when I asked my teacher.
That's impressive. That is impressive.
Yeah. What is this going to bring me, was the question. And if they could not answer me why I should do something, I simply couldn't do it because I had to understand the why behind the training in order to be convinced that, you know, it was good training. And I very quickly discovered horsemanship actually in that time. And it was 90s. So there was nothing. There was no
There was
internet.
Nothing.
No Google.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just a book of Klaus Ferdinand Hempfling, which brought me on this journey.
And there was also, there were basically no alternative riding styles, right?
No,
so I
not
think
even
that
better.
The younger people who are listening to us, they can't imagine that anymore, because today you can choose if you're doing Pirelli or center riding or academic or whatever.
And I was already in that time jealous of Germany, because it seemed like Germany was like 10 years ahead of the Netherlands in that respect, especially even when it came to like Western riding, which was like big in Germany, but not here. And so, yeah, you had your local riding school and then you had your local pony club, and you had to kind of deal with the knowledge that you got there. And I was not content with what I got there. So I already started looking, like we had a school computer that I would go on like Yahoo or something, Google
Ooh.
search engine, whatever, and found this horse whisperer somewhere in the north of the Netherlands who was actually organizing the first horsemanship days in the Netherlands. And he's the one who brought over people like Hempfling and Monty Roberts to the Netherlands in the 90s and organized this kind of like events where this alternative way of riding came to be. And I became a practicant there when I was 15 or 16 in my school holidays. I would travel
Cool.
4.5 hours by bus and train to go there because my parents thought it was ridiculous and refused to drive me. And that's how it started. So I got introduced to all these like alternative things relatively young, and that was my luck. And later on, when I was 18, I was already working at another stable that was doing some kind of alternative riding closer to my home. And there I got introduced to centered riding. So I actually became a centered riding teacher when I was 18 or 19 years old, which I realize now was really, really lucky.
Yes. That was really lucky. I mean, I have a similar story. So my just said I never got an own horse at that young age. But we at that time you had a teacher on your stable or you hadn't.
Yeah.
There was nothing in between. And then I shared a horse with a lady who was bringing a teacher to the farm. And that was a Ben student. That was also very I was a
yeah,
student
I
of Ben.
think I got introduced to academic riding, I think, two or three years after being introduced to centered riding, because there was an advertisement in a Bit Horse magazine, which is like our biggest Dutch horse magazine thing, that he was coming to do a clinic in the Netherlands. And basically my boss told me, oh, there's this really funny guy who rides spotted horses and has a funny mustache and rides with a stick up in the air. Shall we go and see them? We can have a laugh. Naya, okay. It wasn't really like
That was
that.
mean.
But kind of like that, And so I went with him, and the moment that he started to speak about biomechanics and everything, it was like, oh my God, this is so logical. And why is nobody in the Netherlands able to explain things in such a logical way? And for somebody who was always looking for the why, here I got a lot of whys.
Yeah, I guess that is what makes us, or what made us stick to the academic journey, that we got a lot of whys and we got a lot of explanation. Why are we doing things like we are doing them?
Exactly.
And it's also, now we are getting a little bit sidetracked from our original lineup here, but it's also, for me, it's one of the few writing styles that applies learning theory pretty well. What I really, and that is something that I really like about it.
Yeah, I think it was, for me at least, together with centered riding, because centered riding talks about learning theories for the person a lot. And then, of course, the academic is also talking a lot about the pedagogics for the horse. So for me, these were the two ways of working with horses that together gave me more or less a complete picture in how to train people with their horses.
There was a
Yeah. Yeah. So that is why I've been doing this for so many years.
And that is the road that I actually wanted to take with you. And that is centered riding, because I have not so much experience in centered riding, but you have.
Yeah.
And
Academics. So yes.
Yes, exactly. And you still continue to develop further there. So you basically started that road of centered riding and never left it.
Yeah, I paused it for a few years when I just started with academic. because some things were kind of contradictory to each other and very confused. And that's when I had to kind of stop. I never really stopped writing centered writing, but I had to stop getting myself more confused and just focus for a few years on the basics in the academic to understand that part before I could kind of merge them back together and say, ah, in this case of training, you do it like this. But in that case of training, you can do it like that. So otherwise, I was getting stuck with people saying you have to sit like this, or then Ben saying you have to sit like that. And that didn't work for me for a while. But I came back to it after a few years. So really not that long, just 2 or 3 years break, I think I took, so that I could get the basics in academic writing also really, that I could understand what I was doing there and why before I could bring it back together. And I see that actually happening a little bit often to people who do both, and or they're doing one and then they're learning the other, is that there is some conflicts in understanding. And in the end, it's not conflicts. It's just different tools to use in different times.
Yes.
But
and can you fill us in there? Where's the difference, where the differences are and when to use what tool?
Well, the main difference I would say is the light seat. And how to use a light seat in your own body, like, so what to do in your body to sit in a light seat, and also when to use a light seat in training your horse. So in centered riding, especially in the walk, we would usually not use a light seat because we would expect that the horses that we ride in centered riding are able to carry us. They should. If they are not able to use their back correctly underneath us, we shouldn't be sitting on them. Which of course we also say in the academic, but still we sometimes take a light seat to kind of get our seat bones out of the back of the horse so that the horse can, you know,
come up,
lengthen the back muscles and so on. So then also the how to use your body in a light seat is different. So in centered riding, if we do a light seat, we would usually do it in the trot, for example, and we use the light seat to, for example, teach people how to separate their two hips in order to come into a better sitting trot later. So people who have a problem with separating the left leg from the right leg in moving and following the back of the horse, which we sometimes see in sitting trot, and they start to kind of bang in the saddle with their hips locked. These are the people that in centered riding we would take into a light seat for them to find the two halves of the horse's back using a little bit the stirrups, their upper legs, and finding the hinging in the hips, in the knees, and in the ankles so that they can really separate their legs. And then we can take them back into sitting trot and have them keep that feeling of moving with the two legs separate. For that, we use, we would call it a straight back. Yeah, we do not hollow our back. We do not arch. We actually fold in the hip joints, taking the upper body forward. And if you take your behind a little bit back, it still keeps your weight over the point of weight of the horse. So people are afraid in the academic that if they lean forward in their upper body, they would put the horse on the shoulders. But that's actually only happening if you take your weight forward. But if you take
the weight
your
back,
counterbalance, then your weight stays in the same place. So there we have sometimes a little bit of an argument. And also when I learned it, and now I'm talking about a long time ago, so I'm not saying that this is how we learn it now.
Of course.
Learned a light seat in the academic way. It was that I had to bring my stomach forward and kind of tilt my pelvis forward. And that actually blocks the psoas muscles from doing a good job and actually makes it harder to follow the two halves of the horse's back. So there were some conflicts for me that in centered riding, they would say, please just sit on your butt and come back on your seat bones, and so that your pelvis is aligned so that your joints can move. When, you know, then in the academic, I wasn't allowed to sit on the back of my horse. And for the horse I was riding at that time, the academic way actually made sense to not sit on the back of my horse because she had kissing spines and she had back problems. So in that case, the light seat was working better. But then how we were taught the light seat, there the centered riding way was better for me than the academic way because I could still follow the movement of the back better if I kept my pelvis what we would call like scooped rather than tilted forward. So there are some differences.
Yeah, there are some, and it's actually, as you said, it's not so different. different. It's just different applications for different
If you have a
cases.
horse that drops the back, get out of that back. That's what we do in
Very
centered
simple.
riding too. How we get out of the back is different
That's a
based
different.
on human biomechanics. Yeah? So the horse biomechanics, I guess we all agree on, but how the human uses the body in a way to not disturb the movement of the horse is different.
And the exercise you're describing there is, you know, getting light in the seat or closing your upper legs and then bringing the weight backwards and tipping forward is something I'm using, for example, in the seat program on a very regular basis when I'm trying to align a rider who has difficulties to find their point of weight.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I see riders actually who ride with their shoulders behind the vertical. And so what I do is I make them do like a light seat in trot. So they actually come forward in front of the vertical with their shoulders, but find their balance over their saddle and over their feet, basically, with their point of weight. And afterwards, when we align them in the saddle again, they're actually straight.
Yeah. But
So,
that is a, yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, it's often, I also think it's often a very good idea to take somebody out of what they think is balance and just give us the possibility to readjust.
Yeah. And then what I really like about the centered riding, and I kind of, I think that is important in any seat program, is do a lot of work on your habits, your posture, your habits, without being on the horse. So, I mean, and also there, Bent has a point. He always told me, yeah, the horse is not a gymnastic ball to do exercises on. I totally agree. So we need to take the people off that horse and do those exercises on a gymnastic ball or a wooden horse or whatever, to make them aware of what they are doing and to give them a way to kind of reprogram themselves without disturbing the horse in, you know, doing this on the horse for I don't know how many hours and doing it wrong.
Yeah,
so centered riding has amazing exercises on the ground
yes,
that are really helpful to kind of reprogram the habits of a rider.
I like the wording that you're using, reprogram the habits, because it's exactly this. I always like when I was still in Germany, I was very closely working together with a friend of mine who's a salsa teacher. Because we were doing a lot of salsa exercises, and if you had put the student then afterwards back on the horse, you got a completely different picture. That was so beautiful and funny.
Yeah, and that's
and it's
also
fun.
why I've done this bodywork education and working with trigger point therapy and fascia release on riders, because that's the same. I find it much more effective to have them, I would say, 1 hour on the massage table and giving them a feeling of what straight really is, rather than giving them 5 hours of riding lessons. It's more effective.
Very effective.
Yeah.
So this is the three big influences. Now you already brought up the body work. That's the three big influences that you have been working with. And then we have another big influence that has also influencing your perspective and your path of teaching very much. And that was owning Regulus, owning your own. I don't want to spoil it, but the Regulus journey was quite something. Shall we talk about that?
Yeah, and maybe we can even take it a little bit further back in time again. And I have always been fascinated by the difficult horses, as I said. And that also brought me on this way of like, I mean, I spent 5 months in Mongolia for my master's thesis on the Przewalski horse behavior. So behavioral issues have always been another big influence.
Fascinating for you.
Yeah, so it's always been behavior. It's just that how I explain the behavior. So let's put the whys again. The whys have changed. So from a horsemanship perspective, you could explain behavior as a horse being more dominant or more pushy or whatever. And when I started with the academic journey, that why, of course, changed into the horse is out of balance. Yeah? Why is the horse coming into your space? Simply because he has to step forward in order to catch himself. So there already the explanation of the horsemanship part changed, and that why, especially with Regalo, but also with other training horses I've had, because for whatever reason, now I've been attracting them my whole life, the difficult ones always came here anyways. So even before my own, I've had a lot of horses with problems here. And most of the time they would come with behavioral problems, but we would find out that there was not so much wrong with their behavior. It was kind of a normal behavior for the bodily state they were in. And usually that was more than just the horse not being in balance or being asymmetry for nature. Usually there were problems. And so, owning one myself that, was, healthy, we assumed.
You bought him as a healthy youngster?
No, I never bought him. I got him as a
okay.
gift, as a foal. And of course, if you see a happy foal running around, you assume him to be healthy, right? His spectacular movements. It's one, of course, there is no guarantees. But also, like, you don't get a foal x-rayed.
No, usually not.
And we have the saying in the Netherlands that you should never look a gifted mouth, a gifted horse in the mouth. Yeah. I mean, I did have my hopes and my expectations that because this was not a rehab case that came to me at a later age, this would be the healthy horse that I could start working with. Which, seemed to be the case until he was 5 years old or something. And then everything started to go downhill.
Which is a very typical story that I'm hearing over and over and over again.
And actually, 5 years old is early for things to go downhill with, let's give him the spoiler, with an ECVM horse. So normally you see the downhill starting from between the age of like 8 or 10 years old. So basically when they are fully matured, the body can no longer compensate, can no longer deal with the imbalance in the systems, and then systems start to fail. My Regalo had a severe case of ECVM, so maybe also therefore he started to develop symptoms early. But I think also I caught the symptoms early because I am trained
a
and
behaviorist
experienced to deal with problems and to see discomfort in horses. So where most people may have just put shoes under the five-year-old that started to walk sensitive on his front feet, I already started to notice that that is something that is not normal, and look for answers. Like, why is he
why
not
is it like this?
comfortable on his feet? And so maybe that was his luck and my luck, that the why has been very important to explain the behaviors that I saw, to explain the movement that I saw. And therefore, we may have caught it earlier than we would have, if I had not been.
Yes. If you
Aware.
don't have the background that you actually have. And there we have another very interesting parallel in between us, because I have my mountain retreat here for my ponies that you don't have in the Netherlands, but you also have very early on built a paddock paradise, a very beautiful one. Been there a few times and saw it. Looks really, really nice. And the horses have much more, let's say, mental balance also in their daily life. So therefore, we can, of course, catch abnormalities very early, because we know how are they behaving when they are happy and pain-free and healthy. And then we start seeing these small changes quite early on, as I saw it with my Tassilo and you saw it with your Regalo.
And the interesting thing is that, of course, I have been boarding other people's horses in my paddock paradise as well. And I still sometimes have some rehabilitation horses that stay for a longer time, that live in my herd. That you also have kind of a filter for how bad a horse really is in his body. Because if you put them in this more natural environment where they are encouraged to move more, because that's what a paddock paradise really does. They start to move a lot more. If they are too bad, they won't last in this system. They actually get worse. And
that's my experience too. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to say it, but it's a very honest filter. A horse that gets worse walking in, now I would just keep it with my paddock paradise, means the horse is not okay.
Yeah.
And I've had a few arguments with owners about that, where they say, no, but it's just not a good system for my horse. No, but if that horse doesn't fit in that system, yeah, I mean, of course, the system is in that case not good for the horse, but then there is something with that horse.
There's something
You
wrong with
need
the
to
horse.
get it checked. I mean, for me, the point of deciding to put Regalo down in the end was when he could not cope with living in my herd anymore. He could not deal with it anymore. We had a new horse being introduced in the herd and it just went all sideways. And that is where, you know that his body is no longer able to deal with the
To cope
normal
with it, to
way
cope
of
with normal
life.
horse behavior. Yeah.
Yes. And we've had a few horses here that would actually get chased by my herd, who is normally very zen and very balanced. And also there, it's my herd telling me there is something wrong with this horse. We cannot accept this horse in this system, in this group, because this horse brings unsafety. Yeah, it will attract predators that, now are coming back to the Netherlands, but we usually didn't have. But my horses would tell us that this was not good for living here.
Yeah,
And
I've experienced that twice. Also, exactly the same.
Yeah. And you would not pick that up in your traditional way
No.
of, here in Holland, the traditional way still is the horse lives in a box and comes out into a paddock alone, maybe one other horse for a few hours every day. Or the horses are standing in a field full with grass, just eating themselves full the whole day. You don't pick up these
You don't
signals.
pick it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. That's exactly also what I saw. And also that if we are having a dominant horse in the group that is too much in pain, that is too bad himself already, but basically the worry cup is so full that he simply can't deal with another sick horse in the group. Yeah. It's always ending with pain. We are always going down the.
You know what? I just had a clinic a few weeks ago where, these questions come up. And so we talk about it. And people basically said, can we please not talk about these depressive things anymore? Because it makes us so sad. And it's like, yeah, but you cannot be an ostrich and stick your head into the sand and kind of avoid talking about pain because it is a reality. For a lot of our horses, it is a reality. No matter how sad it is to talk about it, it's important that we do. That's why I also really appreciated your post the other day that we have to speak the truth to owners. It's not always a nice thing to discuss, but it's important.
It's important to mention it. I was on a clinic there, and we had a 6-year-old in the course that was showing all the neurological symptoms, up and down, back and forth. So of course the horse didn't want to trot. Of course. Yeah. So then the problem is not the trot, and what can you do? So I was making the owner aware of it and said, shall we do some neurological testing? Just what we can do here on place, that is not replacing a diagnose, but we can film it, you can show it to your vet, and then you can start doing research from there on. And there I'm always grateful for my education with rehabilitation and osteopathy, because then you're learning these kinds of testing at least. And we did all the tests, and it was very interesting because the horse was fine on the left feet, had no feeling on the right ones.
Interesting, right?
Super interesting. So if it would be my horse, I would start with the neck. But there is also many different other possibilities where things can go wrong. But both right feet were collapsing and were not showing any.
And it's interesting that more and more and more, I'm coming into this why again, right? Or like, why are horses behaving as they are? And the why explanation, if there is negative behavior or some resistance in the work, actually always comes down to a physical explanation. And we are not vets. We cannot diagnose. We are not allowed to diagnose. We're not even allowed to use the word lameness officially. We are supposed to use the word abnormal movement. But there is always something. And the problem is just that, sometimes it's a hard truth for the owners to hear. And like, for example, a young who was in training with me that, you know, just is supposed to be healthy and needs to be kind of confirmed in the riding a bit more, who, when you put the saddle on, starts to twitch and turn and shake her head and scrape her foot, it says enough. And I think, and this is the positive part of this message, that the earlier with
you
young
find
horses,
it.
We can see these symptoms, we can see these signals that the horses are giving us, and actually listen to them and address it, the less negative experience the horse builds up in the future, in her cooperation and her lifetime with people. So if we ignore the symptom or the signal of the horse saying, actually, when you put that saddle on my back, it hurts me, or I'm uncomfortable with that, and you do it anyways, you basically just build up a stronger neurological pattern in the horse's brain
in
that
the
says
horse expecting
saddle equals
discomfort.
Stress. Yeah. So we need to be early in catching these signals, addressing whatever discomfort it may be, whether it's a bad fitting saddle or a more structural problem in the horse. So that the horse doesn't have to build up this resistance and this negative feedback loops in the brain. And so right now I'm coming more back again to why I started working with horses, and that is behavior again. It's like, can we make sure that whatever we do in training our horses, we keep a yes, I want to, and a yes, I can feeling in the horse, so that we stay in a positive feedback loop? And if we ignore the signals, I'm uncomfortable, I don't understand, I cannot, and make them do it anyways, like in your example, if you have a horse that doesn't want to trot because he's uncomfortable and you make him trot anyways, then we just build up this, I can't, I won't, it hurts. And in the end, maybe fuck you, I buck you off. Sorry for my language. But we come into a negative loop. And
we see this behavior very often already on the ground. We have to say that, right?
Yes.
We don't only see that when the person is sitting on top of the horse. We see it already on the ground.
I see it with my Noah, who is a gastric ulcer horse, but also an ECVM horse, that if she's on ulcer medication and she feels good in her body,
she
she
can
stands when
compensate
I
the
saddle
other thing.
Her. As soon as she doesn't feel good and she sees me coming with the saddle to the brushing place, she starts to move around. If I want to put the saddle on anyways, she starts to move away from the saddle. Do I have to say, fui, bad horse, you have to behave
you
and
have
stand
to stand
still while I saddle you? You are being dominant for not standing still when I want to put the saddle on.
I
No, it's
appreciate
so clear that when she feels good, she allows me to saddle her. When she doesn't feel good, she shows me that she doesn't feel good. It's the same with my Fitzer, who probably has a lot of stuff because he's 25 and he has a lifetime of injuries in his body. If I want to ride him and I take the halter into the paddock, he comes and he puts his nose in when he's in a good day. The day that he tells me I don't feel good is the day he walks away.
He's moving away.
If I take him anyways, I'm not having a good ride because he's either lame or super stiff. If I allow him to say no and I say, that's okay, we will come back tomorrow. And maybe tomorrow we will just do some groundwork. And then, you know, in a few days, he will
Or go on a walk.
He will put his head in the halter again and he actually feels great in riding. So I think this is science also. Scientists have already shown that horses can say yes or no to things. Do you want a blanket on, yes or no, or whatever, my horses can tell me if they feel good enough in their body and in their mind to work with me on that day or not.
And that is a very important message, because this this pain issue, we have approached this from different sides due to our different experiences, probably, or our biography. That is simply a little difference, because for me the big change was moving to Norway, and for you the reason working with horses was behavior. For me it was always connection, and moving into onto a farm where my horses finally had a life on their own and were able to show horse behavior, just horse behavior that is not in city farm, has been changing my perspective. And then eventually in 2019, I wrote a blog together with my friend Frauke about pain phase, thinking about this is not relevant for me because I'm doing academic adult riding and I am having my horses are living a perfect horse life. And then finishing this blog, putting it online, posting it on Facebook, looking at my own profile picture and thought, this is a pain phase. Damn and it.
Damn it. And I have exactly the same. So going back to the whys behind certain behaviors, even with my academic background, my explanation, my whys were not always correct. Why is he showing that face? Oh, because it's difficult for him. We just need to train his muscles to be a bit more strong. No, he had a sore knee. And training the muscles to be more strong by bending that knee more didn't make the knee more healthy.
No, that made the knee like that. Worse. Yeah.
So there is a lot of different possibilities for why a horse pulls a certain face or shows a certain behavior. And, you know, we are not God. We cannot always know the answers. And we cannot talk with our horses, but we can at least develop ourselves and educate ourselves more and more and more so that we get more and more fine-tuned.
Fine-tuning, yes.
In understanding what our horses are communicating to us.
And that is something here I can put a spoiler in, because just before we have been recording this podcast this morning, I've been recording another podcast, and there I had Emanuela Della Costa as a guest, and she is the researcher behind the horse Grimace scale and the update from 2024 now, also being more refined towards chronic pain, which is often more difficult to catch than acute pain. And this is something that she's working on right now. They are working on designing a study for, showing better when do we have pain in training, when is the pain training or related to a specific movement. And she's just in the middle of it, so they don't have any results. They're actually still in the study design. But she says that, you know, very often we see that the expression of the horse from before to after the training is significantly different. And that's a very important hint for us when we are starting to ask, why are things happening? Where can we help? Do we have a training-related issue? Or do we have a pain-related issue? Or do we have both?
That's super fascinating.
And there I'm really hopeful for the things that are coming, because I think we will learn more.
And it's interesting because this horse Grimace scale, I use it in my work, even though the old one is actually more for acute pain than for chronic. And I still think it says a lot. It's interesting that a lot of people believe that they don't need it because they are horse people. And the argument would be, oh, a horse person just knows how their horse feels. But then I wonder if that is true, why so many of those horse people ride with horses with pain faces. If you would know that your horse is in pain, you wouldn't maybe
ride. No, you wouldn't do that. Nobody with a heart would actually do that, right?
Exactly. So it's actually the fact, and this has happened to me so many times. It's that unless somebody points something out to you and you look at it with new eyes, you actually don't see what's right in front of you.
I also think we have another problem, and that is that pain faces are normal.
Yes.
They are normalized.
They are normalized because, oh, my horse has always looked like that.
Exactly.
Yes.
And we have a lot of explanations for it from a human perspective that are not exactly correlating with horse behavior.
Yeah, I agree. And so here we have the issue of when should we train and when should we not train? So I try to keep it very simple for my students. Yeah, if something seems to be like difficult or uncomfortable for a horse, of course, when I go to the gym and I'm asked to increase the load that I'm pushing with my legs, or whatever, my face will get concentrated too. And I may not look at my most relaxed or most pretty in that moment. I can live with that. But if it is an issue of just getting more supple or building up some muscles to get more strong. If I would continue this training or build up this training over the course of a few weeks with a good fitness trainer, my face expression should get more relaxed again because things should get easier. And if things don't get easier, meaning if after a few weeks I'm still when I do the same, it means that what I'm asking is actually too much for my body. And so my personal like measurement or time scale in this is actually now 3 weeks. If we do a training or a certain exercise for like 3 weeks and we don't see an improvement in the horse's relaxed facial expression and or performance of the exercise or whatever we're asking, it means that we should stop doing that. And it's interesting to see that people still, after doing the same exercise for 6 months, can say, "Oh, but the horse is just weak in the muscles. We just need to train harder.
We need to train harder. Yeah,
You need to train harder." And here comes back to centered riding, my centered riding influence, where we say doing more or working harder is usually not the solution. If you do good training, then less is more. Meaning, instead of putting up the intensity or the frequency, try to put it down and see what happens. So, since I've decided not to work so much on the physical borders of my horses have been improving faster.
Interesting. I spent a lot of time with courses on training physiology, and ever since, what I'm doing is simply when I'm in doubt, I put on a heartbeat monitor.
Yeah,
Just
super. It tells
looking
you.
at where are we in our physiology? Where are we now? Is this aerob? Is this anaerob? How is the training schedule of the horse? How much anaerob work do we have during a session? During a month, during a week? Can we adjust that? Where can we build up fitness? And that is not in working on the borders.
Do you
and
agree that we have
also,
borders
pardon?
also? Do you agree that we have different borders also? There is horses and
Absolutely.
people, we have different borders. There is a border on pain. There is a border on, when your aerobe and anaerobe metabolism kicks in.
Yeah, if you get me now out jogging there, the anaerobe metabolism will kick in after a minute or two.
Yeah, and so when we do that, we're already over the border, right?
Exactly. Then I'm
So,
already over the border, so I need a different training than you.
and then there is a mental border. Especially when there is a memory of pain or discomfort during training. So that mental border with Noah already arrives when I show her the saddle.
You're thinking about the expectation of discomfort
And that already triggers a stress response in the horse.
and that already triggers a stress response, and that already triggers also analgesia to a certain degree if we are riding over that signal often enough.
So let's go back to a very simple example that has actually maybe not so much to do with physical borders. It's trainer loading. I love to just watch how people load their horses on a trailer because most of the time the people are focused on the result. The horse needs to be
Horse
brave
needs to be in.
and go on the trailer, and preferably brave, so not with a lot of force. But even if you don't have to push your horse in with a broomstick and three launch lines, it doesn't mean the horse is always emotionally comfortable with going on that trailer. So there is, for me, there is two layers to this training. It's the behavioral level. The horse gives you the answer to the question that you ask. Can you go in? The horse will say, okay, yes. But then there is the emotional response, and that is how does the horse feel while doing that? Is the horse saying yes, but internally still goes in the red in terms of stress? Or does the horse go in with a huge amount of self-confidence? Yes, I can,
Yes,
and I'm being
exactly.
comfortable. And so already there, I think whether it's trailer loading or groundwork or lunging or saddling, often we look at only the physical behavior. Okay, the horse is standing while being saddled, but what is the emotional response or the stress response underneath that the horse may not be showing by turning around, by protesting, by scraping hooves, there is already something going on internally in that body. And so for me now, it's more important to say, can I stay within the mental limit of the horse,
yeah,
where the horse is really in the green, in the comfort zone, and in the yes, I can, and yes, I want attitude, rather than, okay, maybe on a physical level, he's able to do it, but internally, there is already a lot of alarms going off in the horse.
Yeah. And now I'm asking you a question that I'm asking each of my guests, because pain is always stress, but stress is not always pain. What's your take on this? So how are you differentiating that?
That's a
it's
good
a
question.
Difficult one. That's a difficult one. And I'm getting a different answer from everybody. So I hope in the end we have a big brain pool that is helping us to give us a lot of tools.
Can I talk about it first from a human perspective?
Absolutely.
That is that chronic stress in the end always leads to pain. If we are suffering from too much stress chronically, our muscles get tense, our breathing is affected, our brains actually change. Brains are have a certain plasticity. Certain areas of our brain will get more activated. Other areas of our brain will actually be reduced. So now I'm talking about chronic stress, like burnout kind of stress, right? In the end, it always comes down to physical symptoms.
In the end, yes, in the
In
end.
The end. So a normal stress response is short. It's to survive in the wild. It's to run away from that wolf. And then the whole metastasis should come back to kind of like normal.
Homeostasis.
Homeostasis. Thank you. English. After speaking German, Dutch, English, and French for the last 2 weeks. But,
oh, don't worry. I'm losing my German.
So a short stress response, I think, is always, it's healthy. It's what we need to survive. The problem is when it comes chronic. And what I see with a lot of horses is that they actually mentally resemble burnout people. So horses who are too much under chronic stress. And there in the end, the stress also in the horse will become physical. And it's a feedback loop. You have stress, it tenses your muscles, you get more stress, it tenses you more, and the whole system can swing out of balance. In people with burnout, it actually on average takes 241 days of doing nothing before the brain has reached this normal state again.
Wow, 241 days.
Yes. On average, meaning with some it will be faster, with others it takes even longer. And any stress in that time throws the brain back into its stress loop.
And that's an important information here, because there we also have to say, when we are having a horse that is living a normal horse life or a domesticated horse life, doing nothing, meaning leaving it on a 5x5 paddock, is maybe not the best idea. This is also stress.
And
So
with
doing,
radios blaring all day in the stable and horses coming and going and the horse is being pushed on a trailer right next to the paddock of your horse and all those stimuli. I mean, even for one of my young horses, my terrain is too intense in terms of stimuli. And even with living in my herd 24/7 in the paddock paradise, he is overstimulated from other horses coming and going on my yard. And we have a calm.
Yeah, you have a calm yard. Yeah.
So you have to watch what is stress for horses. It's a lot of things. It's all this human busyness that is already stressing a lot of horses. So back to your question, mental stress and pain related stress. I think it's not so easy to differentiate between the two.
No, it's not. That's where it usually goes down to. But it would be nice to have a few more assessment tools actually also for that. I guess that we can never be sure. We also always have to think in all directions.
I learned
but my
from, but I'm, I don't have much experience with it because I'm doing this course on movement analysis.
Yeah.
And a small sidetrack that we do there is looking at the irises of horses.
Yeah.
Iris. And actually, there they say that there is a certain pattern in the eye that indicates burnout in horses, like chronic stress
Interesting.
overload. And that could be interesting. But I, as I said, I've only learned about it, like that it exists.
Yeah.
I am not a
Yeah.
specialist behind that field, but it would be super interesting. And it's something that I, you know, if my life would have like more hours in the day,
Would like to
would
study
love to
more.
study further. Is how that works, because that would be interesting.
One I have learned is that it's the white in the eye that gets more dominant, but that is also, changing back basically after the stress is gone, and that this goes quickly, and that this is basically the only facial expression where we can say, here we are having a clear difference in between pain and stress.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, that was from my last podcast, no, the latest insight that I got. It's so fun to have all of you, all these great guests here, because I'm learning so much myself.
Well, I just happen to know a lot about chronic stress, just, you know, having been in a kind of burnout state myself. But it's very interesting that, of course, these hormone responses, you know, having adrenaline, having cortisol in your body, that's really not different from a human mammal to a horse.
No.
So all those things that we can go through, we can imagine our horses can go through too. It's just that they can't talk about it. But this state of being constantly overloaded, being constantly on, in the body, I think that happens a lot more to our horses than we think. And
I agree. Since I've been moving out here to Norway, I have seen, I would say I did not really know what normal horse behavior was before.
yeah. And I think most of us still don't, because we cannot offer them what you offer in Norway. This wilderness terrain where they can just be a horse. And that maybe now we come down to maybe make negative thought again.
You would know it from Mongolia.
I know it from Mongolia, but I can also not relate it to horses directly, because it was Przeworski horses and they are chromosomal different than normal horses. So you cannot say that what you see in Przeworski's one-on-one translated to ours. So it's really hard to say what is normal, because also we've been breeding away from normal for I don't know how many thousand years. We've been breeding horses that do as we ask them, that have a huge drive to please, who will compensate their pains or, you know, problems so that they can still do their job for us. I mean, why did our horses get domesticated in the first place? Probably because we could. I mean, we could not domesticate a Przeworski horse the way we could domesticate our domesticated horse. So we've selected horses for kind of not standing up for themselves.
Yeah, this is what we do, and we are domesticating a species, right? We want them to be easy to handle.
And not complain.
Yeah, but for having a less negative perspective on that, we also have to say that none of us is still living like a Neanderthal in a Stone Age cave, and most of us are doing quite well. So within a certain range, we can adapt to a change in environment quite okay and have a quite good life.
Yeah.
Also, just when it's getting too extreme, then it's getting a bit difficult.
But it's interesting because you say this, because also most of our health problems actually are luxury problems.
Yeah, but most of our, I mean, it comes down to three things when we are talking about horses and humans: lack of movement, bad nutrition, and hidden pain. And most often, number three, if we don't talk about genetic diseases, number three comes from one and two.
Absolutely. I mean, most of our problems in riders, now we come back to centered riding again.
Yeah.
Why do we have so many bad patterns in our brain? It's because we sit on chairs, we hang into the back of our chairs, we have a bad posture
sit in front of the
phones and the
computer.
computers, If you look at different cultures where they don't use furniture the way we do, they usually have other problems, but not our modern
Not our problems. No,
problems.
that's completely.
So it's the same with our horses. Why do they have the problems that they have? It's because we don't offer them the movement and the nutrition that they would get in a more natural environment. So sometimes it's going back away from luxury a little bit again to regain health.
And there we are at the start of the conversation again, because I also see that not each horse can survive in this environment anymore. It's just that I often get requests from people who are saying, "Oh, I'm having such a sick horse," or even from colleagues who are saying, "Well, I have a horse that is chronically sick, so I think the extra movement would do him good." Nine. No, especially during the summer period where they are 6 months out in the mountains, I'm seeing that when the horses are too sick, they are not doing well with that. They are not dealing well with that. So it's not all doom and gloom, It's there's a lot of gray shades in between, and there's a lot of life also that happens in between, and not each horse does have to have a difficult story as your Regalo or my Tassilo, where both horses were beyond able to be rescued because they were too neurological sick.
I think what is so important, and that is what we try to give our students. I mean, I'm talking for both of us now, is that we look at the horses, that we can assess properly what is within the range of this particular horse to make him the most optimal, comfortable, and healthy. And to be able to offer him that management and that nutrition that is for that horse the best. The problem is assessing what does this horse needs and then making those decisions and having the possibility also when you like we are both lucky, we have our own place. But if you're boarding your horse and the options are limited in what you can offer your horse, you're kind of bound to what you have. And then conditions can be very suboptimal for the horse. I mean, I had somebody giving a horse back to me simply because she couldn't offer the horse the conditions that that horse could thrive in.
Would
And
have needed.
if I cannot control the circumstances, then I should not have a horse. That was a huge decision for that person. But she said, no option to do it on my own. There is no possibility here to manage my own stable. And the stables around me cannot offer what this horse needs. So it's not fair to me, for me to keep this horse in suboptimal circumstances.
I think
That
that's a
is
very,
really,
very pro horse.
hey, I. These are that's the people who should have horses.
Yeah, that's a,
But
exactly. That's who should have horses who are
in the
thinking like
optimal
this.
circumstances, right? I mean, I could only admire that person.
I'm very impressed. I'm very, very impressed. But we also have to say that often I'm always trying to give people a little bit of hope and saying, it does not have to be 120% perfect. It's very often we can make small changes. And that is already a big impact for equine health and equine welfare.
Well, every step is one, right? So, I
Every
mean,
step is one, yeah.
we all start somewhere. I mean, if we look back at what we were doing 20
Yeah,
years ago,
of
15 years
course.
ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago,
Yes,
I
of
mean, for
course.
me, like my development is just going like this right now, and it's sometimes really scary, but it also means that you have to look at yourself with some kind of kindness and say you do what you can within your knowledge and within your possibilities at that time. If you would still be doing exactly the same thing in 10 years, it means you have not developed. But every small thing that we do in that time is a step in the right direction.
Absolutely, absolutely. And on the last clinic, for example, I have seen a horse last weekend. I have seen a horse, and that was very interesting for me because he was very obviously stepping short in his right hind foot. So I looked a little bit at him, going in walk and trot back and forth. And what was very interesting was that we could see the gait abnormality, but no pain markers. So we also knew the horse had a had an old accident. Say the word, the hook on the right hind leg was not working optimal, so he was stiffening that up, protecting it, but he was happily walking and trotting. Canter inside, I haven't tried it, but I'm pretty sure it wouldn't work. I also asked the rider afterwards and said, "You can't canter him on a circle, right?" She said, No, I'm not doing that." I said, "Okay, just go out in the countryside, do it there." And I even put a heartbeat monitor on him to make sure that I'm not missing something. It's always this personal bias I'm struggling with, that I'm not trying to interpret something into the student's horse that is my own backload. The horse was totally fine. That was very interesting.
But that's possible. I mean, I've had
Yeah, it's
a horse
absolutely
here
possible.
that was actually deformed. Like the whole greater trochanter was not there on one side. So you wonder how the muscles work, right? How the pelvis and the hind leg are connected. The horse showed a very clear mechanical movement
Issue.
defect, but hardly any pain. And this is why I'm always asking myself, like you probably, the same two questions. Is the movement abnormal, yes or no? And the second question is, are there pain signals, yes or no?
And the
Usually.
third question is this trainable, yes or no?
Exactly. And then when I think yes, then after 3 weeks, I ask myself the questions again. Did something change, yes or no? Did the pain expression get worse or better, if there was any? Did the movement get worse or better, if there was any? And evaluating regularly down the road of training with these same questions keeps you kind of hopefully sharp.
Yeah,
To
hopefully
say,
sharp.
oh God, it got worse, or oh wow, it really got better. And this is also why I would always recommend people to video,
Yeah.
so you can put the videos next to each other and say, how was it before and how was it after? Because when there is a small change, whether it is positive or negative, if it's a millimeter every day, you usually don't see it when you stand with your nose in front of it like every day. But if you look at it after 1 month on a video and you compare it, you can say, oh my God, it did get worse. Or, oh wow, it really did get better. And that is like this constant evaluation process that we should be going through when we work with our horses is so important. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I was actually, I'm not doing so many life courses anymore. Starting with that now again next year. Now my daughter is a little bit more grown up, so I'm having more capacity for that. So I really enjoy the courses that I'm doing. And then that means I'm moving a lot in my bubble with my own students, with my online platform, where we are talking about these things often. It's normalized to talk about pain. It has moved away from being ashamed to, oh, this is something that I have been seeing. Can you have a look at that? And my students are talking to that to each other like this too. And that's something that I'm really enjoying, where we get this exchange thing. There's something I'm seeing. Am I starting to get crazy, or can you see something too? So I went out of this bubble onto a life course, and then really a person in the audience was asking me, "Are you telling me these things too when I'm working online with you, or are you only?" We had the topic of straightness on that course, so there was a lot of abnormal movement patterns we could talk about. Are you only saying that here? And I think that in itself was a funny question for me, because I feel that we as trainers, this is our job, to guide our students through these processes.
Yeah, but it's really like I find a lot of trainers find it hard to discuss it, to say, hey, I see that your horse moves abnormal, or I see these expressions, because you are afraid of stepping on people's toes, of hurting people's feelings, and so on. And I think you and I, we have gone over that point by saying, well,
We
we
were
want
deep down
our
ourselves.
horses. And to be honest, like talking about that millimeter change, right? I mean, the last movement assessment we did of Regalo before we put him down and dissected him. Looking back at that video now, I am shocked at how bad he was moving. But I saw him moving every day. So for
You don't
me, it
see it.
looked kind of normal again. And so this is why it's so important that we talk about these things and also maybe put ourselves as examples out there and say, it's not us telling you that you're a bad horse owner because your horse is lame. We have been and are still
in
going
this
through
journey.
exactly the same processes. And so we know as persons how freaking confronting and painful it can be to realize that your horse is maybe moving a lot worse than you thought, or on the other side, to see that some horses really improve. But they would not have improved if we had not recognized the problem to begin with.
Yeah,
because you need to see what's going on in order to have the correct training approach, veterinary approach, medication, or whatever you need to put in to help your horse. So if we are too afraid to say, oh, I'm sorry, your horse is lame, it also means we do not give that person the opportunity to go through the same process and the same journey that we are going through and to come out better on the other side.
To learn.
We take people's autonomy or development away.
Development. Yeah, that's a very important, very fair point.
And
I'm
it's
also you first.
It's not always easy because there are people who don't want to hear what you have to say. And sometimes they do listen, but the result is that the horse doesn't live because it is so bad or whatever. But on the other side, there are thousands of horses that we can help through this process. And actually, I now
That
have
very
people who
quickly.
actually pick me out and send their horses to me for exactly the reason that I will tell them when it's getting worse. And I will tell them if their horse can be ridden or not.
Yeah,
And
that's also my experience. I have a lot of people who are really like coming, like there's just tons falling off their shoulders when I'm saying, yeah, but do you know that your horse is actually lame or that your horse shows a gait abnormality?
Had that feeling in my gut, but my trainer and my vet
Exactly.
were all saying
I
that
have to train harder.
Yes, and he's just complaining, he's just being spoiled or lazy. There's no horse that is spoiled or lazy when they show signals of discomfort, really. So, I mean, yeah, we still have, it's our mission, I guess, to keep
It's our mission.
And in some cases, my centered riding approach helps me because it makes me, how can I say this? The less is more perspective, the taking it back to basic perspective, the persons who come for centered riding are willing to look at themselves, to change their body and their way of riding and moving with the horse before trying to change the horse. And actually, that kind of opens a door sometimes to say, can you feel through your body getting softer what is going on in the body of the horse? And I do find that through this approach, people are already willing to look at themselves as riders. They're usually also getting more willing to look at themselves as horse owners and managers of their horses'
Of their horses.
welfare. And sometimes when we have too much the training approach, training the horse, we are looking at the asymmetries, we are looking at the imbalance, we're looking at the movement, and we just try to fix that by training. I find these people sometimes a little bit harder to reach because their mind is programmed on, I need to change the horse, rather than I need to reflect back on me. And what am I doing, whether in my seat or in my management, that can indirectly influence the horse without making it work harder or move different?
Interesting. Very interesting, because I have a, it's always this, you know, everybody has their own students and their own bubble. I have a lot of students who are so, so focused on self-optimization that we are missing the obvious. That we are missing that this horse is only walking on three legs.
Interesting, right? And we all have our own bubble.
Our own bubble. Yeah, but that's probably reflecting on my own perspective, because this was how I have been thinking for many, many years, that I just have to become a better rider. Then my horse will also move better, which is true. Yeah, which is still true, because even when we are having a healthy horse, we still need to educate our seat. We still need to educate aids. We still need to have a healthy training plan, training physiology. It's still all true. But we are missing this tiny little puzzle piece that says, Maybe there's some discomfort in our pony.
And so my perspective with the difficult horses has always been, why is the horse behaving like that outside the training perspective? Looking at it from the behavioral part, from the centered riding part, from the physical part. It's just that now with the science backing it more and more, and especially with my own experiences, I've just been realizing more and more how severe
it is.
Problems can be. And how many horses actually, it's not the exception. The
No,
exception is the
it's a
healthy
rule.
horse that doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
The one I'm still looking for to buy.
I also feel it's getting worse. It's actually getting worse due to bad breeding or bad selection in breeding, that we get more and more horses with issues at a very young age that have never been ridden, but are still sick
Absolutely.
in one or the other way.
Absolutely. And then we have to think again, maybe also a little bit the question, ego versus not ego. What is it that, why do we keep horses and what is it that we want from them? So, because I think a lot of times we are still assessing horses in their trainability and not in their ability of just being a horse. And I think sometimes it's always like, oh, the horse needs to be used. And if I can't ride it, then at least I want to do whatever fancy long reining groundwork with it, or it should still do a school halt or a levade on the ground. And if that's not possible, at least I still want to get a foal out of it or something.
It's a good idea to breed with a sick
worst
horse.
idea.
Very good idea.
Exactly. But it's always like, what purpose does the horse still serve me as the owner of the horse? Which in some part is valid because we put a lot of money in keeping a horse. So a horse that serves no purpose is just kind of, we're putting money into something that we can't use. But on the other hand, it's a living being. So maybe the question of what can I use it for is already something that we should ethically wonder. If the horse can also just be like, I don't use my dog. He's just there to sleep on my
He's
couch.
just there to be your company.
Yeah. And the horses that we can use within their physical and mental limits are great. But maybe that's the gift. And not what should be expected.
Yeah,
it's cherry on the cake.
It's a cherry on the cake. And it's also the better we can evaluate, the more we are able to find a job for the horse that is suitable for the body.
Yeah. And I do have to say, with my herd, I have a lot of cakes and very little cherries at the moment.
Yeah, me too.
No.
Not so many cherries.
I just love to live with my herd. So actually for me, that's already the cherry on the cake. And the fact that I can ride one or two is a bigger cherry, but has actually gone less important over the years. Now that I've realized how rare it actually is to find a horse that enjoys riding just as much as I do. Because of course, I don't enjoy riding anymore if I know that my horse is not comfortable underneath me.
And there we are again. Nobody with a heart would do, right? And there we can't say it's a bad rider. We also have to look at the horse, because if it's only bad riding skills, we can fix that. I mean, this is easy. That I can fix.
Yeah. And if it's only bad training skills, we can fix it. But it's quite
That's easy.
We have to wonder if it is actually trainable and how then also. Because I also find now, for example, I have an English thoroughbred here in rehab. Actually, she's not trainable because she's really, I'm driving her to the clinic this afternoon to get a knee surgery. But also you have to think, what is this horse bred for? So if I, or the owner, wants to spend good time with this horse would not get happy from working on a circling groundwork or in riding, doing shoulder in and haunches in. It's also like physically, the horse is not very well equipped to do this work. If anything, this horse would be happy going on trail rides on a long rein, straight line in walk through the forest with this owner. And if they can find that to be their cherry,
then
until the day
good
that the
life.
horse's knee is totally busted and breaks down, because the horse will always have pain. It will not be out of pain. But being in pain going on a nice straight line in the forest will be less painful than going around on a circle on that knee, trying to improve something that you may or may not get improving off. Yeah, I would say this people, you know, it's about finding out what you can best spend your time with and what gives you and the horse the most satisfaction in the time that you have left together?
A purpose.
Should it be training, or should it just be enjoying the time that you have, spending it well in the forest? So I'm also looking a little bit at what are the physical possibilities of each horse. And a horse that is not trainable is not automatically not usable. You just need to find out what gives the horse the most pleasure to do.
Yeah. That's maybe a call to the audience and asking, what is your cherry on the cake, right?
Yeah, what is your cherry on the cake?
What is your cherry on the cake? And now I very sadly, I could continue talking to you for another 2 hours, but I very sadly have to end this because I'm driving two horses to the hospital.
You too, me too. So, okay, off we go with the sick horses to the clinic.
Exactly. But this time, not so bad. And hopefully the last examination, because before we are having proper results, we can work with this. Yeah, but this is what we are breeding. It's very clear. My 22-year-old has nothing. He only has a little bit of gastric ulcer, which is starting to laugh about that. So horse is only having gastric ulcer. That's nothing. While my 4-year-old has a dysfunction in his pylorus or in his small intestines. That's what we are testing today. Where exactly is the dysfunction? So we find the right medication. But he's too sick to digest hay. Yeah. So this is what we are breeding. And then it's very interesting. And I have my own research group here on the farm, as you have yours. And we are monitoring him. And we are very often filming him. And now we can very clearly see in the gates when the horse is digesting better and when not, and also on the swing and the swing of the back. And on good days, he's having beautiful movements, really beautiful movements. And on bad days, he's walking like a lame duck.
Well, when I am bloated and had too much to eat or not the right food to eat, I walk like a lame duck too.
Yeah, exactly. Or when we were pregnant.
I mean, of course. And I think it's amazing that your focus is so much on the nutrition. Well, you have to, because of your sickness that your horses have.
Exactly.
On the digestion and so on. Mine is more on the musculoskeletal part. So I have horses with tendon injuries, ligament injuries, arthroses, broken bones, broken necks, deformations in the spine, and you name it. So somehow we kind of get forced into a specialty.
Yes.
And I'm just really happy that you want to share yours. And I'm really happy that I have people who want to listen to me sharing mine.
Yeah.
That's our mission.
Yeah, because in the end, we also need both, right? Because we don't have rehabilitation also in musculoskeletal diseases if we don't get the nutrition right.
Exactly.
And we can feed against gastric ulcer forever if we don't find the musculoskeletal pain. It would simply come back each time we take the medication off.
Yeah, because that's what I see in my horse, huh? That as soon as I take the medication off, the problem comes back. So there is another issue that is constantly triggering the stress in the system. So it goes both ways. And here is, again, it becomes so
it's a
difficult.
Circle.
Yeah, and people kind of feel lost to, like, where do I begin? But I would say you begin there where your horse shows the problem. And whether you want it or not, you become an expert in that that your horse presents.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And from there on, you can move forward. My dear friend, I have to wrap this up here. So thank you for today. I hope to see you soon again on the podcast. And
let's talk more. And good luck with your
Let's talk more. I hope you could take a lot of key messages home with you, and you are not completely desperate, but motivated to look into your horse's behavior from a different perspective. If you need help with interpreting behavior, you can contact both of us, Ilvi and me, for a gait analysis, for a nutrition calculation, and for getting a more multidisciplinary approach on treatment and training, and helping you to find joy together with your horses. See you soon.